This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We'll chat today with someone who is somewhat of a rarity, one of this country's bright young composers, also an accomplished harpist, Hannah Lash. That combination of composer and harpist, not the other way around, is what makes my guest stand out. Growing up in upstate New York, her focus was always on composition, but harp slowly came into focus as her main instrument, on which she is a standout performer. Her studies were at Eastman, Harvard, the Cleveland Institute of Music, and Yale. She now teaches composition at that last institution, and her works have received numerous prestigious awards and have been commissioned and performed by top orchestras, ensembles, and solo artists across the country. One of her recent recorded works finds her setting of the Requiem with her own English updated texts modeled on the ancient Latin. You're listening to the opening movement, the Requiem Aeternam, as performed by the Yale Choral Artists and the Yale Philharmonic led by Jeffrey Duma. I met up with Hannah Lash at her office at Yale a few weeks back.
happy to be here. We've been trying to make this happen for a number of weeks, and we're up at Yale University, where you are here on the department with composer harpist Hannah Lash. Many of the composers I've had on Cadenza over its, well, going into its 14th season, whether they're in their 20s or I've had composers just shy of the 100 mark, I've never had one that's an accomplished artist on your instrument and a composer. But we're going to get to that later, because there's another thing you've done, which is a first as far as a composer, and that's on our more recent recording, music by you, as well as two past Cadenza guests, David Lang and Ted Hearn, and this is your Requiem. I've never had someone on who has taken something like a Requiem and retexted it up to date, which I thought was a really gutsy thing to do. Sort of a microcosm of how you work, too. So just let's talk about that piece, and we'll get to other things. But why? There was no real exact purpose, inspiration. No death spurred this on, right? So,
Yes and no. I mean, I experienced a very poignant death of my dad a few years back. So certainly coming into such close contact with a very important person's mortality was, you know, a pretty profound experience for sure for me. But, you know, it's not a requiem to memorialize him. However, it was something that I felt compelled to do because I think in thinking about death and thinking about how, as living creatures, death is just simply a part of our reality. This was something that, you know, I found myself confronting in a very urgent way over the past few years. And I found inspiration in Brahms's Requiem a lot because, you know, that's sort of the Requiem for the people. And in the sense that he had aimed to make his very universal and very human, mine also aims at that. And in some ways, you know, deviates a lot from Brahms's goal in that mine is highly internal, highly psychological. So in some sense, it's more of an inward journey. So, you know, I'm maybe coming at a more public view of things through a very internal view of things as opposed to the opposite.
The idea with the texting, it's your rewording, it's your updating, if you want to use that word. Again, it's kind of a gutsy thing to do. This is probably one of the most set texts by composers over the centuries there is. When you started this, I mean, was that always the goal? Were you looking at the ancient Latin and saying, how'd you come to that conclusion?
Sure. So where the piece began was actually with the De Profundis motet. And that was initially a commission from Jeff Dama and the Yale Choral Artists to respond to a motet of the past that I connected with. So I took Josquin's five-voice setting of the De Profundis. And what ended up happening was, the more that I thought about that text, the more I felt that where I wanted to rework the idea in the most drastic way was actually textually. So I went and retranslated and rethought and reimagined the De Profundis Acclamavi, that psalm. From the depths I cry unto you, O Lord. I've never felt connected with any religion myself. I mean, I grew up in a Quaker meeting, which was essentially completely free. We just sat in silence, and you weren't asked to believe anything.
Yeah, my sons go to a Quaker school, so we're well acquainted.
Sure. So, you know, and I think a big part of my own upbringing was also to question anything that smacked of dogma. So it was a natural thing for me to kind of come at these texts in a very personal way. So anyway, where I was starting with this was that the De Profundis text was kind of that psalm was the first one to get reimagined.
Right.
And what I found to be really interesting about taking that psalm and reworking it is that you can really find points of commonality with each and every single image, each and every single line. You don't have to stick with a religious imagery at all or language. It can just become a very human, very psychological, very emotional thing. So that's where it all started. And then when it became a bigger project, it was a natural thing then to rethink the rest of the Requiem texts for many different reasons. You know, that being that the doorway had already been opened into that possibility by the De Profundis.
Were you worried in doing it of, I mean, especially the Dies Irae sequence, just that the English would trivialize it or take, not only the English, but taking out the Christian or the God-centered aspect of it would not trivialize it, but lose some of its punch or something like that?
Well, my Dies Irae is very much centered around the idea of not only the fear of death, but natural disaster.
Right, yeah.
And I can't think of anything much more horrifying than natural disaster, and much more profound and much more real. So, you know, in some sense, I think for me, that felt actually far less trivial.
Now, I was just curious, because, you know, like I said, it's a gutsy thing to do, and it was interesting following the text and following music.
Turning again to my guest, composer Hannah Lash's setting of the Requiem with her own updated texts to the ancient movements, this is the movement associated solely with the Requiem, the Dies Irae, Day of Wrath. Once again, the Yale Choral Artists, the Yale Philharmonic, are led by Jeffrey Duma, here joined by the solo voice in the work, countertenor Eric Brenner.
Thank you.
Music-wise, there's a lot of some of your other music in this. You can hear your fingerprints, but then maybe because you use Josquin as your... There's a lot of polyphony in here. There's coming straight out of 14th, 15th, 16th century. So I'm just curious that balance.
You know, a lot of what I do as a composer and what I do here at Yale as a teacher is I come in contact with repertoire that I want to analyze. And one of the courses that I teach is 16th century counterpoint. So I hang out a lot with this music. And I find that, you know, I'm at an interesting point, I think, for a composer. I'm in my mid-30s now, and I think I've really come of age as a composer,
right.
You know? And I think part of that process for me was realizing the music that means the most, that I consider to be part of my lineage. And certainly a significant aspect of that is, you know, Occhagam, Josquin, Willard, Lasso.
Well, I remember in the dark days when I had to take Renaissance counterpoint, it was that thin red-covered book. I don't know who, I forget who the author was, but it was deadly boring and awful. And I hope things have come a ways in studying this music since then.
Things with a capital T, but for me anyway, I come at it from a completely repertoire-based standpoint.
Oh, good.
So, you know, I barely touch a text at all.
Yeah, this is deadly Palestrian exercises, film
yeah,
the notes.
Yeah, I don't believe in
all
that.
Two other things. The insertion of a solo voice. I know this is a good friend of yours, but the fact is he's a countertenor too. So it's, again, that kind of harkens, puts it back historically, but also, so just the idea of having a single voice, a solo voice to pop through the texture, and then that choice.
Yeah. Again, this was very much relating to the idea that this Requiem comes from an intensely personal standpoint. So one soloist made a lot of sense in that way.
Yeah.
Another thing that really occurred to me, and you know, not only the fact that Eric is a close friend and an artist that I deeply admire, but the fact that he's a countertenor, you know, there's something really otherworldly about that voice type. And despite the fact that basically this Requiem, I aim for it to be beautiful, I think there's also an aspect that's deeply disturbing about it and a bit eerie. And, you know, I think a countertenor, and Eric is almost a male soprano, really does kind of help to bring that otherworldly quality to it.
When you listen to it, like the last two movements kind of aligned into one another, and you kind of set that tone. Last thing about this, if you look at your output and your compositions, you decided to call this Requiem, not something else. And therefore, you do toss your hat in the ring, forget Verdi, Mozart, you mentioned Brahms, but just this line of composers. And I've always found it interesting, especially with composers, even if they just write something called symphony and number it, or a string quartet and number it, you know, there is that, okay, it's going to be in this arena. Any apprehensions about just using the word Requiem? Because immediately...
Yeah, I mean, that's very much what it is. And I think another thing that I find to be really, really important in being a composer, in being any kind of creative artist, is that those forebears that we have, we can't actually think of them as gods. We can't think of them as untouchable. We actually have to think of them as human, too. And yeah, there's not a lot of bad Brahms out there because he threw away most of his stuff that wasn't really up to par. But there's some bad Beethoven. There's some not so great Mozart, you know? They were human. They had their flaws.
Yeah.
So yes, they're great. And that is an arena. But in some sense, we're all sort of doing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, my latest point with the titling is, if you called it something else, you know, like the Hindemith, the Last Nocturne, it's a Requiem, but it doesn't have the title in there. So, but this immediately just slots it. People are going to see it and say, oh, this is her Requiem.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I felt there was no point in being coy. I mean, why?
Yeah, well,
also,
yes.
These texts are totally my own, and I've titled each movement the original Latin.
Yeah, you did.
So, you know, in that vein, I feel as though it's actually appropriate to title it.
Yeah, you went on with both feet. I'm not arguing that.
Yeah.
Mention your harpist. We're going to get there too. But composing, sticking with composing, I'm just curious, again, because I don't know many. You might be the first composer harpist I know, and that's it. When you first started composing, were you first writing pieces for the harp?
No. So when I was really quite small, I was like 3 or 4, I said to my dad, I'm going to be a composer.
Okay.
And, you know, my parents probably laughed a little bit, but I was really serious. And I said, you know, you got to help me get there. Here, I need some instrument lessons and I need to learn notation, you know, the whole bit. So they were really helpful. You know, I was given Suzuki violin lessons when I was 4, and I began composing some little pieces. And then I took up the piano and totally fell in love with the piano repertoire. But the harp had been a part of my life early because my aunt Patrice is a harpist. And she came through my town with her harp, and I saw it when I was really tiny, and that's one of my first actual formed memories of seeing this instrument.
Well, that was the question on the harp side, because every harpist I've had on, it's like, how did you get to this instrument? Because this isn't it's not in everybody's parlor, it's not something you pick up at school.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, who wants to play harp in second grade? It doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen, absolutely. But as a composer, you know, I don't know why that idea occurred to me. I do remember listening to Bach with my dad and saying to him, like, who made this? Like, and I wanted to...
Right.
I wanted to do that, too. So that was definitely... But it's the piano repertoire that I really fell in love with, and I think most of my early pieces are probably more piano pieces than anything.
Since this was your idea, mm-hmm. it's not like somebody in school said, hey, you should be a composer.
Yeah.
You had this. Who were you listening to? Bach. But I mean, who else were you listening to more in a more recent memory that was like sinking in and saying, is it Bartok or something? I mean, who were you listening to?
Messiaen was one of the first slightly more recent composers that just grabbed me. You know, I have an uncle who was a cellist at the time, and he had performed the quartet for The End of Time, and he sent me his performance of it. And I don't know, I was probably a preteen at the time. So I'd already been composing for a little while, but I still remember I was lying under my bed listening to this cassette tape over and over and over again. I couldn't stop.
Since you've given us kind of this is how the harp came into your life, once you started playing the harp and you realized you could perform on this, you know, you could, as a composer, you had a leg up on a lot of composers, right? Because this is one of the hardest instruments to grasp.
Yeah.
You know, and they're always sitting next to the harpist saying, can you do this? Can you do this? Can this be happening? You know, so I mean, even accomplished composers. So I mean, was that kind of cool that you could write for this instrument and it was second nature for you, obviously?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think the other thing that I've taken in a very personal way is that for me, the harp repertoire is very poor, and I've really taken it on as a project to kind of go in and fill in the gaps in a way. And I really believe very fully that the harp is a much closer relative of the piano than most people will admit. Most harpists will admit. You know, most harpists will say to composers, don't give me a piano part to play, I won't play it. And I will say to composers, write a gorgeous piano piece and we'll make it work for the harp.
Okay.
So, you know, my most recent project has been to play as much of the Schumann piano music as I possibly can on the harp. So recently I've been doing Waldseinen and the C major fantasy, and, you know, Kreisleriana is next on the board, and we'll see what happens with that.
Why Schumann? I'm just curious.
Long, lifelong obsession.
Okay, it wasn't how
big
it lays
obsession.
On the harp.
Yeah.
Is that tone color, because you're a harpist, is the tone color just in your head, so you'll find pieces you write, you know, it's a natural tone color you either want to put in or have to fight not to put in, you know what I'm saying?
I don't find myself fighting it. I do love it. You know, it's interesting, when I write orchestral pieces, I do find that a lot of the resonance is sort of front-loaded, and I'm sure that's why, I'm sure that's why. This sense of almost creating a meta-harp in the orchestra. But it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, I don't feel limited by that necessarily, but I do feel as though it's kind of an aesthetic that I've gravitated towards.
Here, combining her talents, are the first minutes of my guest's harp concerto for solo harp and chamber orchestra, performed here by a chamber orchestra put together at Yale, led by William Boughton. The soloist and composer is my guest today, Hannah Lash. Thank you.
There is interesting, if you do look through your output, well, what I find with younger composers, and by saying that I'm saying under 40, mm-hmm. okay, is how they come to write their pieces. I mean, yes, it's nice if you get commissions, and I don't know how you can talk about commissions and things you got going on, but there's an interesting story that involves a vacuum cleaner.
And oh, yes.
What it does is it lets our audience hear, well, this isn't like you're not sitting with the Beethoven lightning bolt coming through
right.
and saying, I have to put this down on paper.
Right.
You know, this is just something, well, you can tell a story.
Sure. Yeah, so a few years back, you know, I'm a neat freak. I'll just say that right out. So I like to clean my house a lot. And I had a pretty kind of ratty old vacuum cleaner that just wasn't doing its job too well.
Right.
And I wanted a really good model, like the kind that cost $400 or so dollars. And I just, you know, I was a junior faculty. I didn't have that kind of money to burn. So I just kind of had this idea all of a sudden. So I posted on Facebook, you know, hey, whoever would like a 3-minute encore, I will write you a piece if you buy me a really good quality vacuum cleaner. So the number of responses that I had to this was actually really overwhelming. So I received not only 2 vacuum cleaners, but also a blender and a couch and a chair. And so, you know, I...
You'll be looking to outfit your house.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I'm about to move. I may do this again.
So we'll finish this. So the piece you wrote, I mean, as far as its title and everything else, because the title is off-putting because it means something else in other languages.
Yeah, yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So the Mari Kimura is this wonderful violinist and composer. She was one of the first people who responded to this. So her vacuum cleaner piece was one of the first that I had written, and she got me this Miele vacuum cleaner, which is a fantastic quality German-made vacuum cleaner. And she recommended it. She said, I too am a neat freak, and I will only clean with a Miele vacuum cleaner. So I said, okay, if it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me. And I wrote her this piece, which was basically sort of this overtone.
Right.
It plays on an overtone series in a kind of a silly way. And then it goes into this kind of like asymmetrical dance in the second part of the piece, which I thought was sort of funny because it turns, you know, the overtone series, which is so very static, into something that's far less static because of the asymmetrical nature of the dance. So anyway, and I titled the piece Miele because it was just this sort of silly, sweet little piece, and it made me feel as though the word Mio, honey, you mm-hmm. know, was kind of apt in that sense. So that was that project.
Which, again, shows that the lightning bolt of inspiration isn't always cracked up to be. You had something else that happened in your career. It's funny when we think about past composers, and sometimes you'll read history of either composers who have been forgotten or major composers we have gaps that, you know, there was some kind of catastrophe, like a fire, and it destroyed their music.
Mm-hmm.
You had kind of the 21st century equivalent of that, which
yeah,
is
right.
frightening these uh-huh. days for a composer, and then you had your laptop stolen and it had your music.
Yeah. Yeah, I had stupidly not backed this thing up as I should have. And I don't tend to save manuscripts, too. I mean, in the end, it's just basically all comes back to my own stupidity. But at the same time, it was a fantastic catalyst to kind of say, all right, Hannah, it's now time to kind of grow up and write the music that you really want to write.
Right.
So I did. I feel as though 2010 kind of marks the beginning of my musical adulthood.
Hmm. And you didn't try to recreate anything that was lost? Or...
No, you know, it was actually a fabulously freeing feeling. And there were
some... After the
initial
terror.
Yes, and I was mad about it for a while, and, you know, it felt highly unjust and everything like that. And I could have gone back and recovered some PDFs and some manuscripts because I didn't throw all of them away. But, you know, it just seemed more trouble than it was worth, honestly. And looking back at it now, I do remember at a certain point or another just feeling like, well, you know, in a certain sense, I've been given a clean slate. What a gift.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to become an adult.
8 years, isn't it?
So here's that vacuum cleaner-inspired work, Miele, for violinist Mari Kimura, performed by her, music by my guest today, Hannah Lash. Thank you.
Well, where are you at now as far as either genres or styles or something that you want or need to compose? I mean, you were talking, I read something a couple years back, you were thinking of an opera. Did the Beowulf thing ever happen?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if it did. And so, I mean, where are you at? I mean, as far as what you're producing, what you want to get to mm-hmm. in the next year, things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I have a lot of really cool projects. You know, I've just sort of finished the initial, it's not quite a draft, it's more finished than that, of a chamber opera for string quartet and three singers. And so that's one thing that'll be in the works and continue to be worked on as it gets workshopped and then performed eventually in next year. And then on the board, I have a flute concerto, a double harp concerto, a double concerto for piano and harp, three big string quartets, a like 20 seasons long of solo harp repertoire, a piece for solo snare drum, a piece for trio, harp, viola, flute, a piero piece. I have a lot.
That's a ton.
Yeah, yeah. A couple orchestra pieces.
What was the extended harp?
Yeah, right. This is a project that kind of relates to what I was saying about it being a very personal project for me to kind of go and fill in the gaps for the harp repertoire, because it really is a very poor repertoire. And it occurred to me that it would be really cool to have this project where I would sort of time warp myself back to various eras. So I'm still very much writing from the perspective of Hannah Lash, but if I had lived, let's say, in, you know, 1720 or something like this forward, which is in some sense what I do with the De Profundis and the Requiem too. Mm. It's very much in a style that I consider to be my own, but yet it takes the tools that were used in the 16th century. So that's this project. Actually, I'm going to start, you know, back a bit. So I'm starting in, the late German Baroque with two books of probably preludes and fugues, although I think I need a slightly more personal aspect. So they may be something else than preludes, but definitely fugues.
So this isn't parallel the history of the harp. It's a compositional
Shadow
back using the harp.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So then, you know, after the Baroque gets filled in, then I'm going to the early classical period and so forth and so on. So, you know, eventually I'll end up, as I said, with upwards of something like 20 seasons worth of recitals for the harp.
Is this supposed to be something as a sort of pedagogical for a harpist to be able to play, or that you're going to just write them with whatever virtuosity they require?
Yeah, I think they're very much for myself, although I hope that other people will play them as well, but I'm not approaching them in any kind of graded pedagogical sense. That doesn't feel authentic to what the project is. It's more about, you know, what music needs to happen. So, it's being commissioned by this fantastic couple on the West Coast, and I will be busy for the next many, many, many years in this project. So.
It's better than the vacuum cleaner thing you can use out of this. Yeah, well, it is, like we started the conversation, it's just a unique pairing. Do you know of another composer who's an accomplished harpist?
No, not quite in this same vein.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a few harpists who have sort of taken up composition.
Yeah, the other way around.
Harpists,
that's why I didn't know how to do it at the start. You're actually composer slash harpist.
Right,
but
right.
There are many harpists slash composers.
Yes.
But you're the absolute opposite.
Yeah, exactly. So that is a very strange combo, really.
Yeah.
Here's a work for solo harp by my guest today, composer-harpist Hannah Lash, this titled Stalk, and performed by one of the great harpists in the world and former Cadenza guest, Yolanda Condonassis. Thank you.
I gotta ask this because another thing you are is a woman.
Mm.
And we just had a Woman in Music Day back at the end of June, and it was very successful that they reconcentrated not only composers but artists as well and all that. But I mean, if you look at just look at the Pulitzer Prize for the last few years, right? So, you know, as you said, you're in your late 30s. And before, I mean, how has your path been as a woman composer? And then you obviously have a number of students here
mm-hmm.
who I'm just curious what you think, how the changes you've seen over the last maybe 20 years or so. Take yourself back to your late teens and then where you're at today. I mean, there's certainly plenty of examples, plenty of mentors now of very successful composers who happen to be women. I mean, it'd be nice if we can just drop the whole gender thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you talk to very successful women composers, they say, well, you know, it's still an issue. It's gotten better. You know, same with women conductors and all the rest of that. But I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, it is an issue still. And it's such a big topic. It's actually difficult to get into in a short amount of time.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I can say that my own perspective on this has been that, you know, the music that I connect to very deeply and the people that I consider to be my forebears are actually all male. And I think that to a certain extent, this has been perceived by people who know me as a bit problematic. But my response to that has been, it's not at all problematic. I have just as much claim to this music as you do. And if I feel like writing 16th century counterpoint, which did belong to men, let me appropriate it
mm-hmm.
and let me take it and let me have it because I can. And the same with any other type of music. And it doesn't mean that I'm perpetuating the social structures from which that music arose. In fact, I'm lifting it out of those social structures and giving it new life in a new social structure, which hopefully is more equitable.
Yeah. What about some of your students? I mean, like I said, we've come a long way. I mean, it's been just a little bit over 100 years, right, where Amy Beach was told, well, women don't have the mind space to compose and play piano. I mean, so we're a century plus past that. And then, you know, from mid-century on, you've got a lot of, and then just in the last 20 years. I've been just curious as to the younger composers, if they're a woman. I mean, do they see any impediments at all, or are they seeing it as a pretty wide open field and talent is what it comes?
We're in an interesting time right now because we're all very sensitive to this issue, so we're all thinking about it a lot.
Mm.
But yet, I don't think we have yet transcended the more difficult internalized aspects of sexism, which are very much ingrained in us. So, you know, girls are taught from a very young age to be probably more polite and deferential, for example, than their male friends are taught to be. You know, boys tend to raise their hands a lot more in class than girls do. So something like that, which, you know, seems as though it's a potentially relatively small issue which should be able to be surmounted, actually can become an enormous impediment and can almost sort of metastasize as one gets a bit older, you know. And it takes a great deal of self-conviction to be a composer. I think you have to be a bit of an egotist, honestly. I myself have found that, you know, the compartmentalization of self is tremendously important in that regard. I think I can talk a good game in terms of my own egotism in my artistic field when I can tell you quite honestly that I'm anything but in a personal sense.
Well, it's a strange profession because it's very solitary. And then when it's not solitary, you have to be your own publicist.
I'm not good at being my own publicist. That's not where I'm good. However, I do have a great deal of conviction in what it is that I have to say musically. I really do. And I feel as though I've developed a really kind of steely way forward in that sense. So I think what I have sort of figured, especially with mentoring young women, is if I can help them feel galvanized in that sense, in the belief in what it is that they have to say musically, but also beyond that and deeper than that, to strengthen the craft with which they say what they need to say so that they can find the belief. Because for me, I think what it does come down to is craft. And that's where I found my confidence. I think as a teacher, that's always what I come back to is craft.
And there'll be more of your music available soon. There's a new Focus recording coming out of your stuff. Anything else on the horizon that we'll get your music out to a wider public that we can look forward to?
Sure. So this large harp project that I mentioned is going to be recorded and sort of documented along the way.
All right. Is that going to be documented on like either a commercial recording or a downloadable thing, or will it go to YouTube?
Still slightly in the works, certainly on my YouTube channel, which has a lot of my harp stuff on it already, but, you know, probably through a commercial outlet as well.
Okay. Well, look forward to anything that comes up with
Thank
that.
You.
Keep it rolling, whether it has harp in it or not. it's such a nice combination because you're totally free in using the instrument, so it shows up. That's great. I close on my cadenza reviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat, like we've been chatting, but with someone from the past who you never had a chance to. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops in your head?
Schumann.
Schumann. It really is that much of a fascination.
Yeah, I would chat with Schumann about harmony.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a Schumannite too, so I don't know if that's the word, but that's...
Yeah.
Of course, you have to catch him in the right swing, we'll put it that way. No,
yeah, that's true. It's true. I feel as though I'm kind of on the same wavelength, though.
I think he's been overdiagnosed with late 20th century, 21st century psychoanalysis.
Oh, big time.
But, you know, according to Clara, I mean, he could be sitting in the room not talking to anybody for months. So that's from her words. Final thing is, everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy with not only your position here at Yale, but composing. But when you have to step away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but you need a respite, pull it away. What do you do?
So I run, you know.
Okay.
I like running. That's kind of my sole hobby. You know, my days are very packed because I practice a minimum of 4 hours every day. And so that time management has to be pretty tight.
Okay.
So if I squeeze in, you know, a half hour, 40 minutes of running, I'm lucky.
That's harp practice.
That's harp practice. Wow. And then the composing on top of that. So, you know, there's little room for sort of recreational things in my life.
And now you're going to do this gigantic centuries long.
Yeah.
Hannah Lash, thanks for taking some time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Composer, harpist, Hannah Lash. You can find out more about her at her website, Hannah, H-A-N-N-A-H, Lash, L-A-S-H.com. The recording with her setting of the Requiem with her own texts is on the Naxos label, which also incorporates her setting of the De Profundis Clamavi, or the Out of the Depths I Cry to Thee, Psalm 130. Check it out. At Naxos.com, it is paired with works by David Lang and Ted Hearn. It's performed by countertenor Eric Brenner, the Yale Choral Artists, the Yale Philharmonic, all under the direction of Jeffrey Duma. I leave you with the final minutes of that work, of the final movement, Libera Me. Music and texts by my guest today, Hannah Lash. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.